Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Julie Ellenbecker, president of Ellenbecker Investment Group. EIG believes in the importance of education, allowing people to gain the knowledge to feel confident in their personal decisions. This show highlights the unique financial perspectives of its many guests, including economists, attorneys, book authors, business owners, and tax professionals. It is provided for general information purposes only and does not consider your particular investment objectives or financial situation and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for you. Before acting on information on this show, strongly consider seeking advice from your own financial advisor. The opinions expressed on Money Sense do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Ellenbecker Investment Group employees and leaders. Please enjoy today's show.
Money Sense is brought to you by Ellenbecker Investment Group, four-time recipient of the Better Business Bureau Torch Award for business ethics and integrity. Ellenbecker Investment Group is the only Wisconsin investment company to receive this prestigious award more than once by providing exceptional planning and extraordinary service each and every day. Go to ellenbecker.com and listen to Money Sense Saturdays at 2 and Sundays at noon.
Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Jamie Williams, wealth advisor for the Ellenbecker Investment Group. Ellenbecker Investment Group is located in Pewaukee, just north of I-94, between Highway 164 and Highway F, in Ridgeview Corporate Park, also in the Village of Whitefish Bay in the Equitable Bank Building, across from Winkies. We also service clients in Bonita Springs, Florida. Visit ellenbecker.com for more details. Today we have a very special guest. His name is Mark Higgins. Mark is an author, recently wrote this wonderful book, titled Investing in the U.S. Financial History. Interview today is going to be great, Mark. We look forward to it. The book also really talks about the past and looking into how things in the past history of the financial markets and investing kind of relate to today in some measures. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Jamie. I really appreciate it. I look forward to the conversation.
Excellent. So, you know, many of our listeners, having been, you know, maybe new to the show or listened to Money Sense over the years, have really kind of heard from a lot of different people, different authors, different, you know, industry professionals, some in financial, some not. You're definitely credited in this space. Mark, I understand you're a chartered financial analyst as well as a CFP. Mm-hmm. And you wrote this book. It's quite a book, I must say. Very robust, and you know, lot of information in there. So why don't we start with your background and how you got in the business? Maybe share a little bit about why you went toward the process of writing this book.
Sure. So you know, prior to writing the book, I was an investment consultant focused on institutional investors, so endowments and foundations and pension plans. I did that for about 13 years. And where this book came from was, it was really a product of COVID. When COVID hit and it was clear as a pandemic in March 2020, it really caught everybody off guard, including myself. It just seemed completely unprecedented for an entire world economy to come to a screeching halt the way it did. And I think it was Ray Dalio who had mentioned that something similar had happened in around the end of World War I and the Great Influenza. So I started reading financial history, and the more I started reading, the more I realized that it was just very rare to see something unprecedented. And sure, at some point, I also was just amazed that there were great books out there on financial history, but they're usually period specific or issue specific. And it was amazing to me that nobody had written in a single volume the financial history of the United States from all the way back to 1790 to today. So, I mean, I had a lot of experience in writing. It's always been something I've done it regardless of what job I was in. So I decided to take a shot at it. And after reading, I cannot tell you how many books, a couple hundred maybe.
Wow.
Multiply that by three in terms of studies and newspapers and you know, finally pieced together the full financial history of the United States from 1790 until March. It ends in March 2023, and it was published on February 27th, 2024, and it's doing pretty well.
Wow, hot off the press. That is fantastic. Wow. So I'm just curious, you know, people that write books, they have to start somewhere. Mm-hmm. Where did you begin with this? Like, what was your first, notion? How did you say, I'm going to write this? And did the shape of the book take on what you thought? Or is there, did it take on something completely different as you got further?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of morphed. When I originally started, first of all, I wasn't researching financial history to write a book initially. I was actually doing it to help my clients. And it was just over time that I realized that there was a gap. I never aspired to write a book. I aspired eventually to fill a gap that I saw, because as I read more and more, I couldn't believe that there wasn't a book out there. So that was really where it came from. And yeah, it did morph. There were a few chapters that I included early on that were eliminated. Surprisingly, one is actually more relevant than I thought. I was actually just emailing with another author. His name is John Cogan, who wrote The History of Entitlements. And we were going back and forth on the U.S. Navy pension plan, which was the first funded pension plan that, you know, ran out of money after 41 years. So, you know, there are chapters I took out because it didn't seem like they fit. But I would say within a year of starting reading, I kind of had a vision for what it would look like. And it was just a matter of doing the work and doing the reading and piecing together what exactly happened over the last 234 years.
Well, I mean, I've listened to a lot of different podcasts, read a lot of different things. And, you know, just thinking about the last 150 years, I can't imagine going further into this, into the very beginning. Can you share with me a little bit about the structure of the book, how you laid it out in terms of, I think you have different segments to it?
Yeah. Let me, hold on a second. Let me get the table of contents because it's easier to actually look at it. But there are essentially six parts, and it's not a set number of years for each part. It's really something had to have fundamentally changed in terms of the economy or the financial system. And the six parts are, first is building the foundation of the U.S. financial system. And this is from 1790 until the end of the Civil War. And it really addresses some important concepts that are very important today, such as why central banks exist, the importance of honoring and keeping pristine the public debt, and how that was actually very important once Hamilton, when Hamilton did that in 1790. The second part it's called Growth and Grift in the Gilded Age. And this was, you know, the way I describe this section, it goes from about 1866 until roughly the turn of the 20th century. And it really, you're going to develop a higher tolerance for cognitive dissonance, which is holding two competing thoughts in your head at the same time. It was a period of great growth in the United States and innovation, but there was also just an unbelievable amount of corruption and some atrocities too. And it was a very interesting period for that reason. The third it's called Growing Pains of an Emerging Empire. And that goes from 1896 to 1929. And these are the years aided and accelerated by World War I that the United States really surpassed and replaced the British Empire as the world's manufacturer. The most important chapters of the book, and I'm actually releasing a newsletter soon that relates to this, is the Great Depression and global destabilization. And this is it only goes from 1930 to 1945, but what happened with the Depression and World War II, which was a function of the Great Depression, really set the stage for the next 80 years. And a lot of the things that happened then are surprisingly relevant and nobody remembers them. Wow. The fifth part is called The Wealth of the American Empire. It goes from 1946 to 1982. And this is, most people don't realize, after World War II, the United States was in a very, very unique position. We had 70% of the world's gold. We had the only intact industrial infrastructure. And not only was it intact, it was significantly magnified because we were supplying all the allies and we had the world's reserve currency. And this, it was a great time, but it also enabled the United States to develop some bad habits, which are very relevant today because they relate to the growth of the U.S. debt. And then the final part is called The American Empire Strikes Back, my favorite title. And it goes from 1983 to 2023. It starts with the rise of Silicon Valley. And this part really tracks the transition of the United States from an industrial superpower to a technological high-tech superpower. And it ends by describing several events that people are very familiar with one, the global financial crisis in 2007 to 2009, which was a very legitimate a very severe crisis by any historical standard, and then the COVID-19 pandemic. But what's interesting is when you get to the end of the book, with the COVID-19, like everybody thought the last 4 years, everything that happened was completely unprecedented. It was not. And what was interesting when I was writing that chapter is I'm frequently referencing, well, you know, this happened, see chapter 14, this happened, see chapter 19. There's nothing really unprecedented. The only thing that is unprecedented in actuality is the massive growth of US debt.
Yeah.
In a non-wartime situation. That is unprecedented. And it's the biggest challenge, in my opinion, of the 21st century.
No kidding. Yeah, that is something actually that, you know, has shifted and changed so much over the last few decades that it's profound, really.
Yeah.
Let's go back. I'm curious because obviously there are so many founding fathers in the country who had a hand in forming the banking system, the modern, you know, banking system that we some of that resembles in even today. Talk about Hamilton. Let's go all the way back to the beginning. And were there any key points or takeaways that you would have that were like, wow, I had no idea how incredible this was?
Hamilton was incredible. I mean, there are two people in this book that stand out as absolutely extraordinary. The best investor, I would argue, is Hetty Green, who hardly anybody has heard of. She lived during the Gilded Age. We can talk about her later if you want. And the second is Alexander Hamilton. And what was amazing about Alexander Hamilton is, first of all, he was self-taught. Second of all, he saw the way financial systems worked in a way that really were not appreciated for another 100 years. And
Wow. There
are so many quotes that I use throughout the book that he said more than 230 years ago that are shockingly relevant today, whether it's the importance of maintaining the credit of a nation, the importance of repaying debt once emergencies subside, and the financial system that he developed. The United States was a financial mess in 1790. Yeah. You know, bonds of colonies and that were issued during the war were trading at 10 cents on the dollar. And he established a three-part program, which was, one, honoring the debt and committing to paying it back, two, funding it, and consolidating, by the way, all the state debt into, you know, single federal debt. Two, establishing or raising taxes, really, tariffs to ensure that it could be funded. And then three, establishing, it was a rudimentary form, but establishing the first central bank in the United States, the first bank in the United States. And that was way ahead of his time. And it had a profound effect on the... I don't think the United States would have survived if not for Hamilton.
Thank goodness we had leadership at that in that right time in our history. Yep. We've been meeting with Mark Higgins, author of Investing in U.S. Financial History, where this book is an educational piece. It really outlines a timeline of things going back to the late 1700s and leaves us right off with March of 2023. So we're going to take a quick break. Mark, thank you. And we'll be back right after this break. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams, Wealth Advisor with Ellen Becker Investment Group. Today, we have a special guest, Mark Higgins. Mark is a Chartered Financial Analyst and CFP, a Certified Financial Planner that recently finished up a book that he released in February of this year. The title is Investing in U.S. Financial History, Understanding the Past to Forecast the Future. So, Mark, before the break, we kind of were talking about our founding fathers a little bit. We talked a little bit about Hamilton and his vision to kind of structure things as they are today. Are there any other influences that really stand out in the book or in your research that you highlight in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned earlier Hetty Green. She was an investor who just dominated markets during a very tumultuous time in the late 1800s and early 1900s when there were no rules. There was no Securities Exchange Act of 1934. So people could manipulate markets and do insider trading. And she just, every panic, she outwitted it. And she just had all of the attributes that you would expect for an exceptional investor. She was thrifty, she was patient, she was disciplined, and she never used debt, which was the ruin of a lot of people at that time. And she was a great inspiration. So I continued to have quotes on the wall from Hetty Green. And she's kind of catching a little resurgence here because of some of the articles that have come out recently that rewrite the history. She was known as the Witch of Wall Street, which was entirely unfair. She was not a witch by any means. And she was very misunderstood, but she was an inspiration.
That is amazing. Just out of curiosity, where, like, did she have a particular approach to investing? Was there any theme, you know, back in the early 1900s?
She would be categorized as a value investor. But, you know, the people that she reminds me of are Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. And what really, she just, you have to be patient. You have to be disciplined. She was very thrifty. She was honest, and it was just a rarity back then. And the way I came across her is there were a lot of so there wasn't a central bank in the end of the day, not until 1913. The second bank got destroyed by Andrew Jackson in the 1830s, and then a central bank didn't reappear until the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. So there are frequent panics and depressions. And the way I noticed her is she just kept outwitting them, you know, in 1857 and 1873 and 1884 and 1893 and in the panic of 1906, she was just always ahead of it. And that's how I came across her.
That's amazing to think that, you know, without the internet, without, you know, information age that we're in today, that someone could be that successful and, you know, use fundamental information at their fingertips. I know many of the other investors, I think you mentioned Warren Buffett, the research that they do, and it's just reading, it's pouring over data, it's really making solid decisions, which, you know, I'll tell you, just from our view, the landscape of investing in technology in the last 20 years has changed so much, even before that, but still in the last 20 years. What are some things that are on your mind today after having looked back, kind of looking ahead, that you would be thinking about or questioning in terms of, you know, the current investment landscape?
You know, I don't think things have changed as much as people think. I would say the biggest issue today, and I think it applies to both institutions and individuals, is there is an underlying incentive for investment advisors, for asset managers, to complicate portfolios in a way that typically adds fees and in a way that doesn't add value. And you've seen that steady progression really since 1934, when market manipulation and insider trading were outlawed, and, you know, active management and eventually alternatives became the way for a lot of investment professionals to make money. So that's probably the biggest change I've seen. But, you know, in terms of, there's a great quote from John Kenneth Galbraith, which I need to rip off the wall at some point, but it's very rare to see true innovation in financial markets. Usually it's, his quote was something to the effect of, it's the brevity of memory that causes people to think that a financial innovation is an innovation, when it really is just some permutation on the past. And the way he would describe it is usually in a less stable form. And that's true. I mean, a great example, it's happening today, or maybe not today, but recently, the GameStop, that's a stock pool. It's a stock pool and market manipulation. Yeah. And people are surprised by that, but those occurred every week prior to 1934 and throughout the 1800s. That's how you made money on Wall Street. So people think of that as unique. And yeah, there's a little twist on it, and that's crowdsourced. It's a crowdsourced stock pool.
Right.
But it is not new. It is something that is tried and true, and it was outlawed almost 100 years ago for a very good reason.
Absolutely. And thank goodness that there was regulation. Yeah. And at least today. Now, I think in your book, you refer to what you referenced as manufacturing portfolio complexity.
Correct.
And that would be taking something that should be very simple, making it seem much more robust or sophisticated,
yep.
and really maybe achieving a similar result, maybe not.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you about the advent of, you know, ties into a little bit of the modern portfolio theory,
mm-hmm.
You know, where you referenced in your book some of the people that were, you know, thought leaders in the industry, Charlie Ellis, Burton Malkiel, you know, Never Those Sharp, and the concept of, you know, active passive investing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you view the current landscape today versus where people were trying to do the same thing maybe 50, 100 years ago by buying individual stocks? Has that really changed the landscape of our industry?
No, I mean, I don't think active, you can tell from the book, all the evidence that I've seen leads me to believe that the vast majority, and by vast majority, I mean well north of 90% of individuals and institutions would be better off entirely in low cost index funds. I mean, and I feel like the biggest disconnect is, first of all, you understand the history of why active management developed. And even the stock operators prior to the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, which outlawed insider trading and market manipulation, they didn't bother with securities analysis because they intuitively knew that it was too hard. That mm-hmm. the way you made money was to manipulate the market and engage in insider trading. And I feel like the biggest misconception now is that people are used to hiring specialists to do something that they can do better. So, you know, you hire a plumber to fix when you have a leak, you hire a lawyer if you have a legal option, you go to a doctor if you have a medical problem. And there, I think that carries over into looking at investment professionals, that they're smarter than me, so they should be able to outperform the market. But that's not how it works. There's a principle that's well established called the wisdom of crowds or the law mm-hmm. of large numbers. And the challenge with stock picking is that when you have something of uncertain value and you have a lot of people making guesses of that value, it tends to converge on what the actual value should be. And, you know, there's a great way to illustrate this, which is guessing the jelly bean guessing contest, where you have a jar of jelly beans, you have 200 people guess how many jelly beans are in the jar. And the average guess is actually usually pretty darn close to the actual amount. And more importantly, it's going to be better than, you know, more than 90% of the guesses. And that's really what's going on with active management is, ironically, the more smart people, it's not because people are stupid, it's actually the opposite. It's because they're actually really smart. And the more people you have guessing and analyzing securities, the harder it is to be better than the average guess. And that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, I'll say that is really a shift that over the last couple decades, we went from having a few dozen exchange-traded funds to now there's something like 2,700 different exchange-traded funds. Some of them, most of them have a different idea or theme to it where it's more active. But then you've got this indexing that, you know, you can get the broad base, you know, the Buffett bet, right? He went out and bet the hedge fund. And it's hard to beat the index. It really is. So,
yeah, it's very hard. And just the same, the longer you go, it's kind of like watching people. It's like watching a full room of people who say they can count cards in blackjack. And there's probably one or two in there that actually can and the rest can't. And the longer they sit at the table, the more of them drop out. And that's really what's happening. So the longer you go, anybody, you know, you can get lucky in any given year or even 5 years, but to do it for 20, that's not easy.
That's the long haul. So we've been meeting with Mark Higgins, author of a book, Investing in U.S. Financial History. And we've been talking quite a bit about a number of things. We're going to take a brief break here. And when we come back, we want to share some thoughts and ideas on the current landscape of the interest rate environment. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams with Ellen Becker Investment Group. We're here today with Mark Higgins, an author who wrote a book recently that came out in February, Investing in U.S. Financial History. Mark, in the book, you share, you know, some things about leading us right up to inflation, you know, what we experienced right through the end of COVID. I was curious on that. You know, can you share what your experience was learning about the past financial actions of the Federal Reserve in terms of other inflationary environments, and if there's any similarities or things today to kind of reflect
on? So there are really two periods that are relevant to what's going on today. The first, which is less relevant now, but was very relevant a few years ago, was the inflation of 1919 and 1920, which followed the near simultaneous end of World War I in November 1918, and the second most deadly wave of the Great Influenza right around that time as well. There's a third wave, but it was less deadly in early 1919. And what happened is very similar to what happened today. You had during the war, you had a lot of federal spending, which was, you know, inflationary. You had very low unemployment. You had monetization of the debt in support of the war, and you had supply chain issues because the entire world was in a total war basis. And then you had the Great Influenza. So, you know, people were not spending because they couldn't go anywhere. There's a lot, they didn't exactly know what was going on like they know today, but there was a lot of pent up demand. So after World War I and the Great Influenza ended, suddenly that demand got unleashed and you had very high inflation in 1919. Now the Fed paused in terms of raising rates for a lot of the same reasons they did today. First of all, they didn't expect that was going to happen. Second of all, they were worried about the banking system because a lot of banks had loaded up on Victory and Liberty bonds in support of the war effort, and they were worried that it was going to destabilize the banking system. So finally, the Fed caught on. They raised rates aggressively in 1920, and you had a deep but short-lived recession through 1921. So that was kind of what COVID looked like initially when inflation started increasing in roughly the spring of 2021. And, you know, the Fed, as we know, the Fed reacted belatedly, but they acted aggressively and raised rates by 525 basis points in a relatively short period of time. Yep. And it brought inflation down, but it didn't extinguish it. And now the pattern, the historical time period that is most relevant is different. So inflation has now been at elevated levels, well above 2%, for more than 3 years. Yeah. And if the Fed doesn't get a hold on it soon, and if they bail out too quickly on the tightening, you risk higher inflation expectations becoming entrenched in the economy. And once that happens, it's much more difficult and painful to extinguish. And that's precisely what happened in the late 1960s, which led to the great inflation which really lasted from 1965 to 1982. And the reason why Paul Volcker had to raise rates above 20% to get inflation down is not only was he fighting high inflation, he was fighting high inflation expectations, which were entrenched in labor contracts. They were entrenched in just individuals planning. They were entrenched in price increases that were planned for companies. That is much more difficult to extinguish. And that is the problem that the Fed needs make sure they don't, the mistake that they need to make sure that they don't repeat, which convinces me that not only are they going to hold rates for longer than the market anticipates, I think there's a very real chance that they need to raise them. I would argue they do need to raise them. Now, whether they do it given around an election and, you know, some worries about the banking system is another question, but they're in the danger zone.
Yeah, I'll say that it's been a very interesting rate environment over the past 18, you know, to 24 month period. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, talking to our team and we were reviewing some investment strategies for clients, and we started talking about, you know, hey, you know, if there's a specific need for something, maybe the client should look at a 6 month T-bill or, you know, a bank CD. It's like, wow, we haven't talked about CDs in years. I remember, my first desk job at a bank, you know, in the 90s, I was writing bank CDs for clients at like 5%, you know, 4 or 5%. They had money markets. This seems very reminiscent of that era, in fact, within the rate environment. Mortgage rates obviously tie into the U.S. Treasury 10-year And that's hovering at what, 4.35 today. And then, you know, you're looking at a spread above that, you know, that has a very profound effect on purchasing power, on a lot of things. So
yeah,
I am
enough,
eager. Yeah, right. Exactly. I am very eager to see what happens in this economy. But thankfully, you know, 2022, you know, coming off of that horrific year for the market and the fixed income markets, you know, we started to see some positive signs last year. And now, you know, we've got things like AI, you know, you can't turn on the news or open a paper without seeing something relating to AI. And just kind of looking back at bubbles, right? It came up in a discussion the other day. Does this feel like a bubble in the tech space?
And yeah, I don't know if it's a bubble, but I think it's history would strongly suggest, history of technology development would strongly suggest that the expectations are too high for what AI is going to do. So there is a great book by Robert Gordon. I forget the name of it, but it really looks at productivity and the growth in the United States over the last 150, 200 years. And what people tend to underestimate, people overestimate the impact of technology on productivity. It does increase productivity. It's been very good, particularly at the internet at the end of, but it was relatively short at the end of the 20th century. But when you compare that to innovations over the prior, call it 70 years, they pale. The productivity right. advancements pale in comparison to that. If you look at, you know, think about electricity, air conditioning, home appliances. I mean, you don't have to carry running water. Those the impact of on productivity of those inventions, they seem, we take it for granted today. Automobiles, you take it for granted today, but that was a massive impact on productivity. And the period, I think it's roughly 1920 to 1970 in the book, of productivity growth was, you know, at least double what we've had during the computing age. And I don't think AI, to me, seems that much different. Is it going to improve productivity? Sure.
Yeah.
But is it going to rival air conditioning and automobiles and washing machines, electricity? I'm going to take the under on that.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, from a marketing standpoint, I'm just starting to see a lot more people kind of capitalize on the buzz of it. But it is fascinating to compare it back to the late 90s with the .com, you know, era, and, you know, looking at garage startups with valuations that were in the billions. And, you know, today you have well-established, you know, companies that have big data and big computing that are getting behind this. It will be interesting to see how it evolves. But I think someone recently said there's just going to be applications in different fields and different areas. There's going to be winners and losers.
Yeah.
So, but to compare it to, you know, other big things in history, it will be a game changer for sure. It is going to be interesting to see how that unfolds.
Yeah.
You know, And also, quite frankly, a reason why we diversify, you know, in our portfolios, why we're not overly concentrated in certain areas.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a brief break here in a minute. But when we come back, I do want to come back to, you know, some of the things that occurred with the Great Financial Crisis and talk a little bit about, you know, what happened with the housing bubble and just kind of try to understand what has changed within the landscape of, you know, the financial markets and other things since that period. So we will be right back after this break. Welcome back to Money Sense. We've been talking with Mark Higgins, an author who recently released a book, Investing in U.S. Financial History. Much of, you know, the past historical events going back to the 1790s, you know, how some things relate to other periods of time in history. And a very fascinating topic, Mark. Again, we appreciate it. Before the break, we were talking about a number of things relating to inflation. The housing crisis of 2008, 2009 is something that stands out for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, just based on your research and the things that you've seen, you know, we can't ever predict that that won't happen again. But is there anything that happened as a result of that period of time that people maybe can take some comfort in terms of regulation or things that might have improved those markets?
Well, I mean, it was a legitimately rare event that you don't see. What, first of all, in the book I titled it the Great Shadow Bank Run, because that's really what it was. You had a big shadow banking system, and a shadow banking system is essentially entities that act like banks but are outside of the regulation and ability of the Federal Reserve to assist in terms of crises in a panic. And that's essentially what you happened. It was actually sort of similar to what happened in the panic of 1907. It was a little less similar to what happened in the crash of 1929. It had some similarities, but I think the panic of 1907 was the best comparable. And, you know, so what really distinguishes crises like this that makes them particularly bad is not only do you have speculation, which you did in the real estate market, but you also have the financial system participating in it, and not just being facilitators, but actually making huge gambles themselves. And when you have a run on the shadow banking system, which is what happened, particularly with the investment banks, but also with money market funds, then you got a really dangerous situation. And the Federal Reserve, eventually, the problem, more was necessary than what the Federal Reserve could provide. And that's when the federal government had to step in with TARP. So it was it's impossible to go over in just a couple of minutes, the full dynamics of the crisis, but you essentially had a relatively rare and severe crisis. You had a massive shadow banking system, and you had a nearly catastrophic run on a bank run on that system.
It's incredible. I, at that point in my career, was making commercial loans, and we were underwriting, you know, commercial credit. TARP came along, and it was really a byproduct of the haves and the have-nots and whether you're going to make it. And the bank that I was at did not make it through that. So very interesting time in U.S. history. But I do want to also make sure we touch on a few other items in our time together, because we are wrapping up the show here. You know, I want to talk a little bit about the fiduciary environment, because I know you're in the institutional side. You've been working with clients at that level for a long time. We're on the retail side. We do a lot with individual investors, households. Have you seen a big shift in fiduciary, and maybe just kind of talk about what that means for a minute, in the business over the last couple decades?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I've seen a shift at the institutional level, but the thing that I have seen increase is just the detachment from the evaluation of costs that trustees are incurring by making portfolios more complex, by using active management, by using alternative asset classes, which are very expensive, without often analyzing at all whether the odds that they're going to be worth it, that they're going to provide incrementally higher returns, are worth those fees. And what a lot of trustees don't appreciate, and I'm going to be writing more about this too, is that this is actually a requirement. If you look at the language in the UPIA, which, you know, guides trustees, there are specific I'm going to read it right now, actually. It says, in investing and managing trust assets, a trustee may only incur costs that are appropriate and reasonable in relation to the assets, the purposes of the trust, and the skills of the trustee. Wasting beneficiaries' money is imprudent. And I don't think it was ever fully appreciated to the degree it should be, but I've definitely seen deterioration over the last 50 years in acknowledging that requirement and living by it.
That's spot on with some of the ethics components to the CFP, you know, whether you're a trust officer and you're acting in a fiduciary capacity on the institutional side, or you're acting in that fiduciary capacity representing clients with their wealth management. So that's where, you know, tying it back to planning here at Ellenbecker, we lead with the fact that we're a registered investment advisor acting in a fiduciary capacity, and all of our advisors are mm-hmm. acting in that role. Don't want to insult any plumbers or people out there that do different lines of work, but you know, it's not often that you'll run into everyone that is in a fiduciary capacity, putting the best interests of the client first. And especially when it comes to cost, quality, diversification, and complexity. Yeah. So Mark, just kind of wrapping up here, you know, again, we really appreciate everything that you've gone through with us today. Awesome book. Tell us how we can get your book, and who does this book really relate to the most? Who could benefit from this?
Yeah, I mean, I think there. When I first started writing it, I envisioned just writing for investment professionals, but I've definitely learned that the audience is much larger than that. It's being used at Fordham to be one of the main textbooks for a class on essentially manism panics. I think it has a lot of applicability with government policymakers to understand the history of past panics and past Federal Reserve policies that worked and didn't work. I think there's applicability there. I think there's a lot of, I know there's a lot of applicability because a lot of sales are international for other countries that want to understand how the United States works and how it evolved. There's, you know, I think there's a lot of lessons that are applicable outside of this country. So, and then just individual investors, I think some of the things we've talked about on why index funds make sense, you know, I can't promise anything, but this could save you a lot of money knowing that you might not be doing the right thing by paying a lot of fees. So, you know, I think there are a lot of audiences. In terms of getting the book, you can order it on Amazon. It's available at Barnes & Noble. It's a few locations, and it's available online. Internationally, it depends on the country, but it is being sold in a number of countries. So it should be, the easiest way is to go on Amazon, and Investing in U.S. Financial History is the name of the book. I do have a newsletter too, though, if people want to sign up. It's called Investing in Financial History, and it's on Substack, and that's really the best venue. I actually have a newsletter coming out on D-Day. That it's essentially on war and finance, and you know, if you want to get that, it's free. You can sign up for the
newsletter. Wonderful. That's great. I will do that actually.
Great.
And then in our last minute or so here, I just want to put it out. Is there a biggest lesson? Is there a biggest takeaway? Anything that you took away from all of your research that either you already knew it and you just validated it, or it's something completely new concept that you're.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing that underlies all of the insights and lessons in this book is that people generally don't think in the right time frame. That if you, I mean, I joke about it, but I joke with my wife sometimes, I feel like a 234-year-old, you know? And when you are able to contextualize what's happening in the context of hundreds of years, it is very rare to see something surprising and to overreact to it. And I a lot of the mistakes that investors make, it's because they're not thinking over the right time frame, and they react in ways that don't make any sense if you're thinking like not 200 years out necessarily, but 20 years out or 30 years out or even 10 years out. People tend to think couple weeks out in terms of their reaction, and by extending your memory backwards vicariously through our ancestors, you can hedge that weakness. That's universal. I mean, everyone has it naturally, but that's the way to hedge it.
Well, that's speaking like a words of wisdom right there from going back in history. So thank you, Mark. We've been meeting with Mark Higgins, author of Investing in U.S. Financial History, Understanding the Past to Forecast the Future. You can find his book out there on Amazon. With that, Money Sense airs on Saturdays from 2 to 3 p.m. and Sundays from 12 to 1. If you like today's show and want to know more, please visit us at www.ellenbecker.com or call us at 262-691-3200. As always, we hope that we've made a difference in your personal and financial well-being. And also remember that before we plan, before we advise clients, before we invest their money, we always listen. Thank you again, Mark, for a great show today, and enjoy the start to your summer.
Thank you for having me, Jamie.
Thank you.